You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
It is tour live. We are in Singapore, but we are not live. Live, it's 5 a.m. back where you are. We do not want you to get out of bed for this. I've got Ian Doyle, I've got James Pearce, and I've got John Gibbons all here for us, all settled down, having a good time on tour, and we'll talk to you about that in a minute or two. Also to come, we have got, we'll chat about Liverpool's deal with Standard Chartered, which is part of the Singaporean experience. But we'll start off talking about the biggest news from the week, and the best news from the week, John, which is the Senate report into what happened at Paris has completely exonerated Liverpool supporters, which should be the end of that. I hope petty tribal rivalries in England will be overlooked, although I might end up being very optimistic there. But the truth of the matter now is that there's nowhere else to go. The French Senate couldn't have been more emphatic in its 15 recommendations in what it's brought from this inquiry. Liverpool supporters on the day, as tweeted by Ali McGovern, more than anything were heroes, very much not the people who were to blame for the events.
Yeah, it's a good vindication, isn't it, for Liverpool supporters who, you know, we've been clear and spoke as one voice from the start about our experiences and about what happened. And now it's there in writing. There's been an official report done by the country, by the host of this event, and they've, you know, generated Liverpool fans have said, you know, systematic failures were to blame for all the problems. So like you say there, Neil, it's there in writing. If anyone wants to disagree with that, then, you know, you just look like flat earthers, really. But I think, you know, what's interesting to me is what happens now, really. So this is fantastic. The truth is there. It's there for everyone sort of plain to see. But now, you know, how do we ensure that it doesn't happen again? And that's my personal, you know, concern from the off, really. And what I'm sort of most interested in is, and not just the big finals, but generally, you know, whenever Liverpool fans, football fans, you know, travel to different countries in particular, you know, how can we assure that the police correctly? Because we've all, who've been to games, you know, especially when you travel away to watch Liverpool, been, you know, had police treatment that you just sort of get used to it and you realise that you shouldn't. Yeah. And I think for me, you know, what I would love to see for this is, you know, more pressure put on, you know, police forces, UEFA, because it's their competition, on treating fans better and treating fans, you know, like they're human beings who just want to go and watch a football game.
This report set the scene for the UEFA investigation, Ian, and you would think, although given what UEFA are capable of, it may not prove to be the case, but you would think it boxes UEFA in, but the French have investigated the French and have drawn these conclusions, should lead UEFA to draw very, very similar conclusions. Because if they don't, they'd have to be able to really explain why they're going against where the French have ended up. But that is good news for that report as well, because it just means that we're closer and closer to a situation where all authorities who are involved in this event are able to say that the Liverpool supporters, and for that matter, anyone else who attended the game, and we'll include Real Madrid supporters in this as well, that we didn't have a very good time at all in some instances, that those supporters had nothing to do with the chaos that was caused.
I mean, UEFA boxed themselves into a corner right from the start with the announcement in the stadium that it was the late arrival of fans that was, you know, delaying the kickoff, because we were in the stadium, we saw that, we were like, well, that's not right. And, you know, the impact of social media, that at the time we were speaking to people outside the ground, sure, the same for yourselves, and we knew that things weren't right out there. But, you know, UEFA do have a reputation of trying to sweep things under the carpet. They don't really address things properly. And going back to what you mentioned about tribal rivalries, what's interesting for me is that I've had quite a few conversations with fans from other clubs, but they're the ones who've been to European games, have been to big events, they're the ones that said, you know, I really hope Liverpool fans get this sorted. I hope that, you know, they're done right by the French authorities. I hope that UEFA deal with it as well. And, you know, they're totally exonerated, which it looks like they're going to be. Certainly, you know, as you mentioned, in France they have been. I think it is possibly more important that UEFA do as well, though, because, you know, France might have the Champions League final this year. They might have it for a few more years, but there's going to be another one, another one, another one, yeah, in other countries. And you can't just, you know, say, well, in France it's not going to be a problem now. But say they go to Spain, Italy, it becomes an issue there as well. And the common denominator in all of this is UEFA.
From our point of view, James, the response to the club has been very, very strong all the way through. Billy Hogan released a statement, a video as well, very, very close to the release of this report, which was good to see. It feels like Liverpool, when we are talking about the sort of change that might need to happen at a UEFA level, are prepared to lead the charge on that now. And, you know, to see that from the club is really hard.
Yeah. And I think from the fans that I've spoken to that were caught up in all that chaos outside the Stade de France, I think the way in which the club has stood shoulder to shoulder with them over the last month or two means a lot to them. And it, you know, even down to, you know, a nice gesture that I know the club has contacted everyone who travelled with kids to the final and are boxing them off for free tickets for the game against Strasbourg at Anfield before the season starts. So I think that's been an important, you know, Billy Hogan's voice has been important in terms of keeping that pressure on.
And the manager talked about this week as well.
Yeah. And that all helps, I think, because, you know, it was, you know, you speak to people in France and it was, you know, it was a national embarrassment that such a major sporting event descended into such chaos, especially when you look at some of the other big sporting events that are taking place in Paris in the next couple of years. So, and yeah, you get a bit weary, don't you, with things too often just get swept under the carpet and it's like, well, it'll just be the same next time. But, you know, we all hope that this time around there will be lasting change. And as you said before, you know, the pressure has been cranked up on UEFA now because, you know, they need to start taking responsibility for the disgrace that they oversaw in Paris rather than thinking that they can just peddle lies and deflect the blame elsewhere.
There is now, John, you know, there's still more to be done. People will listen to this and we're lucky to be able to speak to people who are from outside Merseyside. People who are listening to this, certainly in France as well, but across the rest of the UK, if they can contact their MPs and push for an unequivocal apology, push for, encourage them to encourage the French authorities to do a judicial review of this so that Darmanin has to speak under oath. People have to explain why they've said what they've said to this point. All of that can only help at this stage. And, you know, we've shown we've got the capacity for that. And we've also shown that on this one, there are milestones here which we're hitting and we're meeting, so that this is the time, you know, not to feel disheartened, quite the opposite, to feel like, no, if we, there's a process that we can follow here and we can get our political representatives to follow and we can feel as though we can get some form of result and eventually possibly also some form of redress, and all of that feels as though it is very, very possible at this point. So if people are listening to this, it would be good if we keep the pressure up.
Yeah, 100%. Listen, every Liverpool fan who has done something has made a difference and got us to this point, and that might just be, you know, sharing something that Dan Austin's written on Twitter, or it might be, you know, writing to your MP or anything small that you've done sort of publicly to say, you know, to put pressure on has helped. But then, and we need to just keep going and keep putting that pressure on, really, because I think France have been conscious throughout that this is an international story and it's involved obviously two football clubs with worldwide support who are absolutely huge, who've been united together in one voice, saying that, you know, what both sets of fans, you know, experienced that night was unacceptable and went way over the line of what you should expect when you go to football fans. And to be honest, that line's probably too far, you know, anyway.
Not too far.
The things we've come to expect from, you know, travelling away is, you know, isn't right anyway. But this was so far over that then everyone's just said enough is enough. And, like Doyle said there, other supporters have stood up and said, yeah, this needs to change for all of us on the right. So, yep. So we need to be conscious of the idea that, you know, putting pressure on, it's been talked about as being a you know, France has been talked about as being a national disgrace, hasn't it? And that's the way that they've, that's the way that they've used it. So they're conscious that it's a big story. So anything we can all do to keep that pressure on and to give more ammunition to the people in France who are on our side. And I think that's important to say as well. We're not fighting, you know, the whole of the country.
No, not at all. It's purely a political establishment.
Yeah, exactly. And certain individuals within that particular establishment, because some of them, like the two people who did this report, so sort of are on our side, really. So we need to keep giving them ammunition and keep going.
Yeah. James, the other big news from the week from a Liverpool point of view is the continuation of the Standard Chartered deal. It felt as though there was a period of time where there was some sort of suggestion that may not happen. It looks as though it's hugely valuable for the club. Obviously, it is the club's main sponsor. It feels very deliberately timed whilst we are in Singapore and that's being announced. But it looks as though it'll be very, very lucrative for the club. And also, they've gone out of the way to also specify that some of that money will be ring-fenced for the women's team as well.
Yeah. I think it is. It's certainly fair to say that there was quite an extended period where it looked like, you know, this long partnership between Liverpool and Standard Chartered would be coming to an end next summer, because Standard Chartered didn't initially renew. Liverpool went out into the market and held discussions with quite a few different companies across various sectors. I think we reported back in April that they'd had kind of extended talks with a number of crypto firms. So that was under consideration at that point. When I spoke to people at Standard Chartered, they were pretty much kind of almost resigned to the fact that it wasn't going to renew. But you know, clearly that situation has changed in the last few weeks. You know, once Standard Chartered obviously had time to weigh up what they would need to pay if they wanted to keep it, because you know the value of the contract is, I think it started off at 20 million a year, I think it was, in 2010 when they took over from Carlsberg. It doubled to 40 million, and now this time around, you know, I think we're looking at beyond 50 million a year. So we're talking, you know, over 4 years, taking it up to the end of the 26-27 season. It's another injection of 200 million quid into the coffers.
I mean, 50 million a year, James, it's about sort of 8% of Liverpool's yearly turnover. This is a substantial sum for the club, isn't it? It really is.
Yeah, huge. And especially, you know, as Billy Hogan said, you know, for a club with a self-sustaining business model, you know, it's even more important, because, you know, I think we all raise eyebrows at some of the sponsorship deals secured elsewhere. And you think, how on earth does that tally? And so Liverpool do have to operate in a slightly different world, shall we say. But and I think as well, you know, Billy Hogan was quite honest and open about the fact that it wasn't the easiest period to be trying to renegotiate as well, with the world economic situation as it is, and coming off the back of the pandemic, and there aren't too many businesses with that amount of money just looking around to invest. But I think in the end, you know, I'm sure Standard Chartered would have looked at it and gone, you look at how Liverpool have grown, you know, from where they were when they took over the contract to where they are now. I mean, and with Klopp especially, I think on the back of signing his contract, you know, you think it's going to be some ride in the next 3 or 4 years, and why would you not want to be a part of that?
The ride is the important thing, isn't it, Ian? And that's what Standard Chartered are investing in. It's also what we want to see. You know, Liverpool, as James says, they are self-sustaining. So whilst this is quite dry in one sense, it does matter. It matters enough to talk about it once on this show and then never talk about it again, if you know what I mean. We don't want to spend our time talking about this. But Liverpool ensuring they can secure every last penny to reinvest back into this team is the most important thing here, and it looks as though they managed to do that.
Yeah, well, as you mentioned, it's not just the first team. The interesting thing is that they've come out and actually expressly said that it's going to be the women's team as well, which they want to invest in. But obviously, for most of the supporters, what they'll just be bothered about is this going to be more money for Jurgen Klopp and the recruitment team, and that's what people want to hear, and that's what's going to happen. It was interesting what James said then as well about the interest in the crypto companies, because speaking to Billy Hogan earlier this week, he kind of hinted at that, but also said the reason that they've renewed with Standard Chartered, part of it is the history and security of the business they're in.
Yeah.
So I do think,
which you cannot say about crypto.
Exactly. That's very volatile, and there's other volatile, you know, businesses, industries, and I think that Liverpool have stuck with what they know, and for Standard Chartered as well, it's great for them, because, you know, Liverpool have got towards 3 Champions League finals in 5 years. You know, they got played 600 games last season. You know, they're their logo is on television around the world all the time. We've seen it all around here in Singapore. We saw it around in Bangkok as well.
There is, when we talk about, John, the security around it, I think that is a big deal for Liverpool, getting the certainty in, being able to plan. The women's aspect to me is fascinating. If we're all frank about the women's game and the finances within there, it actually doesn't take much money to be ring-fenced to make a massive difference to Liverpool women. A lot of the players are on such short-term contracts as well. In there, you know, the finances are very opaque around women's football, but from what we can garner, it wouldn't take very much of that Standard Chartered money going towards Liverpool women for it to make a massive difference to Liverpool women.
No, it wouldn't, that's right. But it's interesting because this isn't the first time I've heard a partner say that they want a strong women's team. And I think, you know, for the people who are saying, you know, whenever these things are announced, you know, you'll always get, you know, one or two saying, oh, no one cares about the women's team and things like this. But, you know, but
the partners do.
The partners do. And I think that's something that a guy and Nike were very big on when they took over, when the conversation started. One of the things they asked was, why is your women's team not very good and this isn't good for us? And I think the Standard Chartered as well, you know, they're wanting the, you know, both football teams to be as strong as possible. And so, you know, it's interesting that this is something that the partners are now focusing on, and it's great that Standard Chartered also want to put money in. Obviously the women are back in the Super League next season. It's going to be tough. It's tough for the promoted team, you know, in the top league always, but, you know, money helps, doesn't it? You know, it's not the be all and end all, but it certainly helps.
It can't hurt.
Yeah, in terms of making sure we're attracting top level talent, and then that, you know, feeds into more people wanting to go and see the team, and it's, you know, it all builds towards success. So, but yeah, no, it feels good news, doesn't it? And it's interesting, you know, we've all spoken to people out here, and when I've mentioned conversations with Billy Hogan, and when we've spoken to people, there's been a keenness for long-term partners, I think, amongst the Liverpool Football Club, and so I think they'll be pleased that, you know, the relationships that they've got are going to continue.
Excellent stuff.
Next up is Harriet Pryor speaking to Izzy Wong, the self-described Divock Origi of cricket.
So it's great to have cricketer Izzy Wong with us, and a huge Liverpool fan as well. But first of all, I'm speaking to you at a good time. It's been a good month for you, hasn't it? You took 3 wickets on your England debut and in the Test match against South Africa. So how's the last month been? Have you enjoyed yourself?
It's been absolutely surreal, to be honest. It all just happened so quickly, especially, I guess, the last 2 weeks. So, yeah, just loving every second of it at the moment. But, yeah, it was amazing to debut against South Africa. Like I said, completely surreal.
You're only 20 years old, so how did it all come about? Because I think you were a reserve to start with, weren't you? And then you were drafted in last minute for your debut. So has it been a little bit of a whirlwind?
Yeah, completely. I was down as a travelling reserve, so, you know, to be with the squad, take part in all the practices and stuff. And then, you know, unfortunately, one of the girls was still suffering from COVID, from long COVID. So got drafted into the squad with about 2.5 days to go until the game started. And then, probably 24 hours before the game, head coach said, want to give you a debut. And I was, how good's that? Yeah.
Does it feel like a bit of a dream come true? I think you said it in a few interviews, that looking down and realising you're playing in the England whites for your country, it must be a really exciting time.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's what you dream of when you're a kid, isn't it? You know, you play a sport, whatever sport it is, you dream of playing at the highest level. And, you know, in cricket, that's playing international cricket in test colours. So, yes, to be able to do that, certainly completely surreal and absolute dream come true.
Yeah, well, you made the headlines, didn't you? Because you came back, I think it was day 3, and that must have been a highlight. You took 2 late wickets, and then you compared yourself to the Divock Origi of women's cricket. So I think that caught a lot of Liverpool fans' eyes. Where did that comparison come from?
Well, it's been quite an interesting day because there'd been a bit of rain about, and we knew that if we got on, you know, a couple of wickets would be key. So I think that's, as a team, that's what we're kind of working towards, just getting a couple of breakthroughs late in the day. And then, you know, obviously lucky to do that, came off and was chatting to, I think it was TMS, and they, you know, they said, oh, you seem like a big game player. And obviously any Liverpool fan that hears the word big game player, there's only one person that springs to mind, and it's Divock Origi. So just threw it out there, and yeah, it seems to have caught a few Liverpool fans' eyes. But, you know, he's a legend of the club, isn't he? So it'd be rude not to.
He is a legend of the club, and he's obviously moved on this summer, but have you got any favourite memories of his that you can reflect on during his time at the club?
Oh, I think, you know, those two in the Champions League, you know, stick out, obviously. The one against Barcelona is just iconic. You know, every time I drive around a roundabout too fast, I'm screaming in the car, corner taking quickly. and obviously, yeah, in the final. Unfortunately, I wasn't there. I had a ticket, but I was playing. I had a warm-up game, actually, with the England women. They called me up from the academy to kind of take part in a game, a warm-up game with them. So I turned down my ticket to Madrid. But I guess it's, you know, little sacrifices like that, well, I guess big sacrifices, Champions League final with the winners. You know, watch them win it, I guess that's quite a big one to turn down. But, you know, I guess last week, that kind of made it all worthwhile. So, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I was going to ask, do you get much time in between your training and playing games to go to come to Liverpool to go to any of the matches, or is it a bit too intense during the season?
During the season, it's tough, but luckily, you know, most of the cricket season's in the summer where there's not too much football being played. Slightly easier in the winter when we're not away, obviously. It's only summer half the time here, so a lot of time as cricketers, we try and spend, you know, the winter away, whether that be, you know, I was in Australia this year, so it's quite hard to watch games from Australia. But, you know, the family I'm staying with, massive Reds as well, so we're waking up at 6 a.m., 7 a.m., 5 a.m. to watch games. Yeah, so it's good fun, really. But yeah, I've been to a few this season. I went to San Siro with Inter with my dad. Nice. I'd just come back from Australia, actually. I think I've been in the UK a week, and he was like, right, we're going to the San Siro next week, so pack a backpack off you go. So yeah, my dad and my brother. My dad has recently retired, so I think he got to 56 this season, something ridiculous like that.
Oh, wow.
He absolutely loves it, bless him. Yeah.
So how did your connection with Liverpool begin? And just go back to the start on that. How did you become a Liverpool fan?
So my dad's been following them since he was probably a teenager. So there wasn't really much choice when it came to what football club I was going to support. Obviously, 20 years old, we've had some challenging times in my life. I remember when we lost to Stoke, that 6-1 loss to Stoke. I remember crying and just being sat in bed and crying and crying. But yeah, it's always been Liverpool. Right from the start, from my dad. Yeah,
it's nice to be on the good side of it now, though, as you're getting older, isn't it? Because I'm the same. It's like when some periods when you're growing up, you're like, oh no, but now we're enjoying it all. But yeah, just go back to your career a bit. So, like you said, you were reserve and you were drafted in last minute. I guess that's something that a lot of footballers experience, coming off the bench and having to get themselves into the mindset really quickly. How easy or hard maybe is that to get yourself in the mentality where you don't think you're playing and then all of a sudden you're coming in to play a really important role?
To be honest, it was probably a bit of a blessing in disguise. Obviously, I hadn't played for England until you know, a week ago. So that's probably quite a big moment in your career that, you know, you might get nervous about, I guess. But the fact that I didn't have too long building into it to think, oh, like, what if this happens? What if that happens? What about this? It was very much like you're playing, and it's like, right, okay, I've not got time to think about any of that. It's just like, what am I going to do? Like, have you got your whites in your bag? Right, cool, get to the ground. So I guess it was a blessing in disguise, really, because it kind of took away all the non-essential stresses, I guess. And it was very much a needs must. Like, this is what I need to do to be ready. Cool, I've done it. Right, let's go.
Yeah, definitely. And you've got a one-day international, I think, coming up. Is it on Monday as we're speaking now? I'm not sure exactly when this will go out, against South Africa. How do you prepare, I guess, more mentally for these big games as athletes, especially when you are young and you maybe are feeling the pressure a bit more at the start of your career?
I think just trying to relax and just think about, I think personally, the way I'm going about it, it's, you know, I think it's okay. Our captain at regional cricket talks about making positive mistakes. So, you know, we don't mind making mistakes, but are we making the right mistakes? Are we playing the right brand of cricket that we want to play? Is it positive? Or, you know, are we actually making mistakes where we've been a bit tentative and maybe not quite made a decision? Or is it from, you know, I've made a decision, I've stuck with my decision, and, you know, it wasn't the right decision, but I went with it and I committed to it. So I think, yeah, just trying to be really positive and, like, saying a mistake's okay, but let's make sure it's the right sort of mistake and going about it in the right way.
Yeah, definitely. And the popularity of the women's game is just going up and up and up. And we've seen it across a variety of different sports, really. We've got the women's Euros coming up in the footballing world. And you can see the buzz and excitement around it. How is it in cricket to be part of that? And do you feel like, you know, you're witnessing that firsthand, that things, that the game is getting more and more popular and there's more and more attention around it?
Oh, 100%. There's no better time, I think, ever to be a woman involved in sport, and let alone, you know, at the start of a career. It's, you know, you see the kind of, like you said, the women's Euros coming up. You see over in America, the WNBA, like there's so much growth in women's sport at the moment. And yeah, it's really exciting because I don't think there's any, you know, there's no roof on it. But, you know, it's down to us as athletes to keep pushing the game forward. You know, whenever we're playing, whenever we're training, it's, you know, we speak about, like, can we move the game forward and play it in the right way? And I think it's a really exciting time to be in the game, to be in any sport, especially women's sport.
Yeah, definitely. It's an exciting time for all of women's sport. And it's also an exciting time to be a Liverpool fan. We've had a good transfer window. Are you looking forward to next season? I almost can't believe that it's coming round so quickly again. I feel like it's just stopped and now we're all getting excited for the season again.
Honestly, the seasons keep getting longer and longer, but there's no complaints over it. Absolutely loving it. Yeah, can't wait. Yeah, we've had a good transfer window. Obviously lost a few legends, but, you know, we've gained a few guys that, you know, hopefully can put their stamp on the club and, you know, help us achieve more than we did this year, next year.
Yeah, and we're speaking shortly after the Salah new contract as well. So that must have been a nice buzz for you. Would you have been playing your test match still, or would you just have finished?
I think we just finished. It might have been the day after, and I checked my phone and I was like, well, this is the best news I've had all week.
amazing. Yeah, it gave us all a lift. Well, really good luck for next week. We'll all be watching closely and seeing how you get on, and then we'll maybe catch up some point during the season as well and see how you're enjoying it and how everything's going. So it's been great to chat and have you on.
Welcome back. We're still in the busy Singapore cafe. We're pleased to be in Singapore, pleased to be in busy places, to be honest with you. It's been an exciting tour. The thing that I keep taking from it, Ian, is the feel-good factor around everyone that you speak to connected to Liverpool. Not just the obvious people. We've all had the opportunity to speak to Billy Hogan. We've all had the opportunity to speak to Jurgen Klopp. But even just the people who are just working for Liverpool, for me, the feel-good, I've never quite known it like this, to be honest with you, and that's staggering to me. Everyone feels as though Liverpool is a great place to be working at the minute, a great place to be, and that stems, I think, from the way in which it feels with the first team and the team spirit, both as a whole business, but also very much with that group of players. I've never known team spirit like it, and I spoke to Jose Enrique earlier in the week, and I asked him that question on a panel thing I was doing, and he says he's never known team spirit like it. He's still in touch with a number of the players as well.
Is it Jose Enrique or Luis Enrique?
Oh, we keep getting that one wrong here, don't think of God. Poor Jose, man.
it all comes from Jurgen Klopp, is where it all comes from. He's the figurehead for the club. You know, they've got a chairman, they've got a chief executive, they've got a sporting director, they've got the players. But, they, you know, when we were at the team hotel and Jurgen Klopp got asked this in the press conference on Thursday, what did he like it? You know, how did he feel about having such a big reaction from the supporters who were there? Because, you know, Mo Salah went past, there was a few cheers, you know, all the other players went past. The minute Klopp stepped out, it was huge cheers because everybody knows that he's the person around which all this is built. And, as you say, it's not just about the first team. The fact that the first team are doing quite well, you mentioned the feel-good factor. Why wouldn't there be a feel-good factor with what happened last season? I know the Paris, what happened in Paris, that's something almost separate to that. But even then, that's underlined, the way that the reaction to that from the club is underlined by such a, you know, the club is so together, because they've been quite keen, as James said. You know, Billy Hogan's been standing up for the fans, he's been going, you know, front and centre, and he's been put out these messages. It wasn't very long ago that just simply wouldn't have happened.
Yeah.
And I think they're all confident enough that they're all on, you know, they're on the same page, and they've got a common goal, and that's to be successful. And when we go back to Anfield this season, look behind the Anfield Road end, you've got this big new stand coming up. They invested in the training ground, you know, and they're going to be investing, thanks to Standard Chartered, in the women's team as well. So everything is positive, and there's no reason for them not being a feel-good factor.
The players feel like everything's positive as well, James. I think this is the key thing, is that the togetherness that you get to see on the pitch is completely legitimate. You know, it's none of it's forced. You watch them in training, but just the general vibe is that of such a united squad, and that's why I think they're capable of putting us all through, and you can say there's a positive or a negative, another 60 odd games this season, because for me they are more than able, I think, to continue at all levels through that squad. Mo Salah, you get the impression you're going to get the best version of Mo Salah and the best version of, let's say, Cade Gordon. Like, all the way through the squad, it feels like these footballers are ready to support each other and be in the best versions of themselves. And as Ian says, that massively stems from the manager.
Yeah. I think James Milner summed it at best in the interview he did towards the back end of the season, where he said, you know, I know all people say this. You might not think I'm being genuine, but he said that there's literally no dickheads in.
Yeah.
And that there is a strict no dickheads policy that hasn't always been the case, I'd say, in all the years.
There isn't one in the press box.
they're actively encouraged. But it's the environment that Klopp has built. It's that you either buy into it or you don't last much longer. You have to. You know, I was on that tour when Mamadou Sakho, you know, nearly missed the team flight, didn't turn up for treatment sessions, and ended up on a flight back long before his teammates.
What I find interesting with this, sort of speaking to some supporters over the course of the summer, sometimes in social, sometimes in person, is there's a bit of a thing where people say, you know, there's this sort of perceived thing with Klopp that he might be insufficiently ruthless or might be a bit too loyal. When you look at the number of players who leave Liverpool in the summer of 2016 and 2017, you end up in a situation where, like, it was a mass exodus. That was him being ruthless. That was him wheezing people out he didn't want to work with. And I do feel, you know, I think that Klopp will always have faith in a certain type of footballer who's given him a certain amount. But almost like, if you don't like that, you don't like Jurgen Klopp, that no manager's perfect, or what you might deem as perfect. You get the whole package, and part of why he inspires such loyalty is because he offers such loyalty to the footballers who've shown it to him as well.
Yeah. And I think, you know, he talks about it being like a transaction that starts before the start of every season. You know, it's very clear, you know, this is what you have to put in if this is what you want to get out of it. And the proof is there, isn't it? You could run through a big long list of the players he's developed and taken to the next level, and on the number of players with big potential that have been elevated to that world-class bracket. But, you know, he is demanding. Like, he expects a huge amount. And if you try and cut corners, then, you know, of course, you know, he's not some... I think sometimes he's probably wrongly perceived as...
Just it's not all hugs, is it?
No, he doesn't just go around cuddling people. But that is genuine, that, you know, the thing about the unity and the camaraderie And you know, I think remember Pep Linders saying, you know, he said the beauty of it is, he said, despite having all of these elite players, he said it is like there are no egos, and he said, you know, that is incredibly difficult to have that kind of situation. I mean, you know, you only have to look at down the East Lancs Road to some of the stories that, you know, when was the last time that there was briefing going on, you know, the camp of one Liverpool player against the camp of another. This doesn't happen, does it? You know, I can't even think of a player that's left Liverpool under Klopp who's then been critical afterwards. I think even players that have been shown the door by him, and, you know, I think Simon Mignolet would probably be a good example of that. You know, he almost, you know, in the end, it's like, you know, you might not have liked the fact that, you know, he didn't think you were as good as maybe you thought you were, but he was honest and genuine with you, and you know where you stand. And again, that a lot of players would tell you that is something which isn't particularly common in football.
Another simple reason for Liverpool's success is they either bring in people, no matter what the job, whether they're bringing people who are either the best at their job or people that they believe can get better. And that's not just our, you know, the playing staff, it's the coaching staff, yeah. it's across the board.
I did an event with Mona yesterday, you know, it's that sort of attitude, isn't it, across the board. We want the best one, or the one who most fits us. What's really interesting about Mona, just spending even just a little bit of time with her, is how much she's into enjoyment, how much she's into, you know, it isn't regimented this. We want you to have choice, we want it to be beautiful, the way when she talks about the food and the colours and all this. We want to educate you. And that was the other thing I thought was really interesting. It's not, you're just going to eat what you're given, you're going to understand why we want to educate. And for me, she's a really good example of this idea of, you've got to have not just an incredible level of ability, but also a certain mindset to be part of this.
Yeah, I mean, just got to bear in mind that for most of these people, it's a job. You know, for us, if we go, I'll play for Liverpool, it's that amazing work, and that'll be brilliant. But for them, it's a job. And if you go into work every single day and you're going into that atmosphere and that kind of camp, why wouldn't you enjoy it? You know, I think that's, again, that comes back, what we were saying before, comes back to Jurgen Klopp. He's the one who's kind of fostered this, you know, that atmosphere, that feeling, that togetherness. And while it, you know, it sounds a little bit twee or something like that, people possibly from the outside go, well, that can't possibly be true. We've seen it. You see it. We've all seen it. We know exactly what it's like. And I think that's the reason why Liverpool are proving so successful.
And coming up now, we've got John Gibbons speaking to
Sam Alexander,
well done, John. Sam Alexander and his cousin Stan about their reunion.
And it is John Gibbons for Tour Live, and I'm delighted to be joined in the studio by a couple of new friends. A month or so ago, or maybe even not even that long, Sam Alexander got in touch with me with a story that he thought would be interesting for us and our subscribers and our listeners, and I agreed. So he's coming along with Stan today. So Sam, I mean, you tell us in your words instead of mine, sort of why you got in touch and why you're here.
Yeah, well, I grew up down near the South Coast. Had a grandfather who died sort of 81-ish. I was 6 years old, and he was from Liverpool. So we've always known we've had family up here. A few years back, we decided to trace them. So I contacted Liverpool. I'm a Liverpool fan, so I've always known since he died, I was given his Liverpool mug, and you know, so I've got it at home, keep a toothbrush in it. It says 12-time champions on it, you know, for a long time back. So we always knew we had family up here, but I'd never traced them, never contacted them. And just before COVID hit, I contacted Liverpool Council and found this woman online, and she helped me, and we were tracing families. She was coming back with emails every day. You know, I found this family member that lived here and there and got married here, got married in Everton, got, you know, died in Everton. And, eventually came through. I found this guy called George on the census, and you know, he might be a relative of yours. So I sent him a letter.
Yeah, I got the letter. It's funny because my dad used to always say, you've got family down south. And there's that generation, they never used to go into it. And I didn't care. I was a kid. I thought, oh, yeah, okay. So, but eventually I thought, oh, I better trace them. And I had friends live down in Epsom, and they said to me, well, where did they live? And I said, well, the only thing I know, he said, is Haywards Heath. So tried to trace them, couldn't find them. And then I used to tell people, you know, I've got family down south. They go, okay, they'd humour me, you know. And nobody believed me. My wife said, no, just say, okay, fine, you know. It was my dad's brother. So I left it at that, and all of a sudden, out the blue, I got this letter off Sam, and we got in touch. And it's like, wow. And there's so many strange things, like Sam's got a TV production company. I had a radio production company. We both work in the media.
Mm.
And it's just really strange. Nice, you know. So we've got together a few times, you know, when he's been working up in Manchester. And came up yesterday, and now we're here talking to you about it.
I went to the match last night, so this is the day after Inter Milan game. And you went to the game, last night. And it's funny, isn't it, the sort of the power of football, if you like, because, you know, I'm sure this, you know, kind of thing could have happened without it, but having that thing to bring you even closer together is a really powerful thing.
Well, it may not have happened. The first thing Sam said to me, he said, are you a red or a blue? So I paused, because I didn't know where he was. He said, I'm a red. That was it then, yeah.
It's weird because, you know, I've been coming up, you know, on and off to Anfield since the early 90s, like my dad would bring me up, or I've been up with friends, you know, been up with work. But just strange to know that Stan could have been, you know, sat on the other stand and never knew. It's just nice, you know. It's nice to have found a family member and got in touch. And then we get to go to the game together last night, which is really nice.
Would you say it's given you an even greater connection with the team and the city, Sam? Because obviously you had, you know, your granddad anyway, and that's where your love of Liverpool has sort of come from. But to you know, have this other sort of family connection, if you like, and have, you know, more of the family story known to you, would you say it sort of, you know, gives you even closer connections to the city?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I've always felt there was something missing. That sounds over dramatic, but I've always known I had this red Liverpool blood in my veins.
Yeah.
And now I've got this connection, and, you know, just driving around today, and Stan's pointing out, you know, Stan as he's known, not George anymore.
That was my dad's name. That's another old school thing. You get called after your father.
Oh, yeah.
And he's pointing out areas of the city, you know, this is where the family were from, this is where they were born, and, you know, this is what I did as a kid. It's a bond and a connection that's come through, really. It's been fascinating just these last couple of days, just coming up and seeing bits of the city that I wouldn't have seen before and pointed out stories.
Yeah,
about.
Sam will spark off something. I'll say, yeah, I remember seeing. I went to school in Bootle, and Roy Evans was my mate then. He played for St George's. He was Roy of the Rovers then. He was such a good player.
Yeah.
And I'm saying, oh yeah, I remember I saw Roy's game here, and for some reason they put him at left back, and he was playing against an Ipswich player called Jimmy Robinson. And I'm saying, and I know how good Roy was, and he gave him Roy the runaround, you know. So I just know how good these players are now.
Yeah,
you
know? Yeah.
So, and I'm filling them in on details. I'm saying, oh, yeah, by the way, you know, that stand, all the people were hanging out the Kemlin Road stand when they were building it, because I'm a little bit older than Sam. And I'm saying, oh, yeah, I remember Ian Callaghan's first game, you know. And I was on the pitch when Kevin Lewis scored, when they went up from the old second division.
Wow.
And I was saying, that was the boy's pen. We climbed over the fence and we went on the ground. That's when they won 2-0, you know, and they went up to the, what was then the first division.
Yeah.
So it's like these memories come back, you know, because Sam will mention something and I'll say, oh, yeah, I remember that.
It triggered something in you as well.
Yeah, it did, yeah. Yeah, because... my dad was a Liverpool fan, and I said, why don't you come with me, Dad? And he said, oh, just come back and tell me how many they won by. Which I always did.
Yeah.
So, and through that, we haven't met them yet, but we've been in contact with Sam's family, and I've been over to Manchester to see him. So it's like, I've proved them all wrong.
Is it been interesting for you then, Sam, to find out a bit more about Stan's story as well? Because he's got a record here with us this morning. He's led a very interesting life. And as someone who, you know, works in the media, who's got a natural sort of, you know, curiosity for people, I guess, it must have been quite a fun experience for you.
Yeah. It's you know, it's a bit of a connection to me. Media side of it, obviously, and you know, Stan's told me from the start that he's a musician and plays around and, you know, still does plays with his friends and that and in different bands around the city. And we were talking about a record that Liverpool bought out in 1983 or something, and he says, oh yeah, I wrote that.
Yeah. So is this a cup final song, is it, or is it just a song that
Liverpool
came out?
We're never gonna stop.
Yeah,
I had a friend called Terry Sylvester. He used to be, remember the Hollies?
Yeah.
I was working with Terry, and I can't remember how the connection came up, but he said, I've got a chance to do a tune for Liverpool. So we hired a studio, we wrote the song, we got all the players down to Kirby, to a studio there, and it came out, and I was actually taking my grandkids on the Anfield tour last year, well, just before COVID, and they were playing it on the cop, and I said, I wrote that. You don't believe me.
I don't believe it.
Yeah.
Any song that comes on, I'll say something. I wrote that. No, honestly, I wrote that. That's it there.
So you brought it in today.
Red vinyl copy.
It's just funny that I, you know, bought a copy of it as a kid. Well, my dad bought it for me. My dad's an Arsenal fan, but he's got a soft spot for Liverpool because of me. And he probably bought me a copy of it and... Never noticed it was written by someone with the same surname.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it's quite a common name, I guess, isn't it? Yeah. But it's right there on the front as proof to any doubting grandchildren.
I'm going to show this now. Save that for them.
So something that you did, Sam, as a bit of a, oh, this might be interesting, as a, you know, pretty cool, you know, I was going to say ending, but it's not an ending, is it? It's a point we're at now and you know, beginning and a friendship and whatever else.
Yeah, it's been great. You know, obviously it was hard through COVID. We had all these plans to come up with the family.
That's right, yeah.
As I said, the woman we contacted, I feel so bad, I can't remember her name, but she was so good, she didn't want any money for it, and she was sending me emails every day about information about the family. She was, and all we had was my granddad's war number and his birth certificate, but she found all this information out. And we've now got all this information as a family, and... Pre-COVID, there was a big plan to come up, wasn't there, with my mum, my dad, my sister, my wife. We're all going to come up and stay in Liverpool and go and look at all these old sites, you know, these old churches and you know, all these places where the family were. Yeah. So, yeah, it's brilliant. It's really good.
And another coincidence, Sam's sister is a vicar down in London, but she's got a friend who's a vicar in Everton Church, which just happens to be the church my mum and dad got married in.
Oh, well.
And that's a weird coincidence.
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, maybe even more to come as you get to know each other even better. But thanks so much for coming in this morning. I'm glad you got the chance to go to the game together last night, and I'm sure a few others watching this magnificent football team as well. Just while you're here, Stan, you know, you talked about seeing all the greats and stuff, and you know, being seeing Ian Callaghan's debut and stuff like this football team for you. Then you know, they must be right up there with the best you've ever seen.
Yeah, it's just the level of fitness and the level of concentration that they show. You know, I don't get a chance to go live very much, but see, when you actually see them at the ground, and you can see that the way they play, the way they've been coached, it's just you just know that they're such a good side. You know, and the way Klopp's got them playing, and it's just great because it's a completely different. Obviously live and seeing them on the boxes, you just see things that you don't see, and I'm so impressed with them now. You know, it's great.
It's early, as we all are. Gents, thanks so much for coming in, really nice to meet you both, take it easy.
Thanks, John.
And now back with John. Thank you very much indeed to James and Ian for giving the time earlier on today. John, we are now getting ourselves ready to go and see this game, Liverpool against Crystal Palace, later on tonight in Singapore. I think they'll be looking for a bit of improvement in a couple of areas. I think it's worth saying that that's the way they see pre-season. We just did a little event with Sammy Hippier there, and Sammy was very much saying it's always about incremental gains pre-season. You want to just see yourself get a little bit better. I think the main thing they'll want to eradicate is just daft errors, if to be quite honest with you.
Yeah, I think that's completely fair, and I think the reason they play so many of these games is, you know, you do want to get slightly sort of better each time, and the idea is you're peaking just as the season begins, or at least as close to it as you can be, and everything allows. Yeah, that has really cost us the other night, you're right, and you know, that's something that happens with young players and inexperience.
It's like a match practice.
And sort of slightly mid-match situations, like as you said on the post-match show the other night, you know, Reece Williams makes that mistake. He's literally just come on into, you know, playing against lads who've been playing for half an hour.
Yeah.
And, you know, his first touch wasn't the best of hands.
Yeah.
But then suddenly they're sort of off. So I think, you know, concentration levels are tough in these heats as well, and humidity, and you know, there's loads of stuff going on. You know, there's excitement, and you know, it's a strange tour, but we do want better from them, and you want you know, we've been at an event this afternoon between talking to James, where you know, you mean all these fans who are going tonight, and you know, say, oh, hopefully it's a great game for you, and you mean it when you're saying that, you know what I mean? And so, you know, for them as well as, you know, for Liverpool's football club's progress, we hope to see, you know, a bit better tonight. Obviously, a goal.
A goal would be great.
Yeah, and a lot more. You know, a lot more to cheer.
I said a goal from one of the big lads. The obvious two are Darwin or Salah. I'd like to see something from Firmino. I think if Jota's going to take a little bit of time to get himself set, and we want to look to protect Darwin, it's worth remembering the first part of the season, there's no midweek games for the first 3 weeks for Liverpool, at least. So that gives us a bit of leeway to get players where we want to get them once the league season starts. But it also means that you can maybe commit to the idea that, for instance, Firmino starts the first three, and he's going to be there to bring everyone into play, to link everything up, to do what we've seen him do his entire Liverpool career, which is just help it gel. And he looked sharp as anything in training yesterday. He was the one who really stood out for me.
Yeah, I mean, he was playing right in front of us, wasn't he?
When
we were watching, you know, the sort of most intently, really. And, you know, it was passages of play, and it was passing through the lines, and he was on the end of everything. And as you say, looked sharp, you know, his touch looked good. And, you know, the manager obviously loves him, and his teammates do as well. And, you know, he'll have a part to play next season, you know, when that is. You know, we all wait and see, really. But at some point, he will get games. You know, you'd be shocked if he's not on a decent number of minutes by the time we sort of finish. And maybe that is earlier than later. Maybe that's his role next season, is to get us off, to help get us off to a flyer, and then maybe other people come into it. Jota after his injury, you know, Darwin when he's sort of a little bit more settled. You know, maybe that's how it goes. We shall see. But he's one of a number of great forwards we've got, and you know, hopefully we see evidence of that tonight.
Absolutely. Other players that I think people will be looking forward to seeing some of. For me, it's the three younger lads in midfield now. If Carvalho's going to play a bit of a role there, it's him, Elliot and Jones. I think all three of them, we keep saying it is a massive pre-season. But the other thing, again, when we've been lucky to go to the training sessions, we're seeing is all three of them look really sharp.
Yeah, they do, yeah. And confidence. So there's a sharpness there. There's a confidence. They feel like the...
you know, they're acting like they belong in this environment with these world-class players. And that's what you need to be, you know what I mean? You can't be overawed in situations, you know. Cavalli in particular, you know, he's come from, you know, being a star at Fulham, but into a dressing room with much bigger stars and guys who've achieved more in their career than he has, because he's only just started. And so, you know, you can be a bit overawed, but he's come in and backed himself up to play his game. And the others are this pre-season too. And so, you know, the manager will be, you know, working out his pecking order, if you like, at the moment, and looking at it and seeing who looks to me ready to go, you know, straight away, and analysing it from there. So these games are all information; they're not be all and end alls, and they're nothing to no one's going to lose anything from a bad game or something. But there's certainly stuff to gain from playing well, linking up well with the people around you, looking like you've been listening to the drills, you've been taking on board what Pep, Linders and Jürgen are shouting at them in these open trainings. And I think that's what he's looking for, really. Are they doing the right things on the pitch? Are they doing what we've asked of them? Are they going to go with the teammates? Are they passing to someone, you know, in a better position than them, and in the ways we've worked on, you know, are they pressing when the cues are there, and stuff like that, really, that we're not always sort of completely switched on to, because we're just looking for fancy flicks overheads and stuff like that. I mean, not quite that, but you know what I mean. So that's what the manager will be looking for, really. You know, who's taking on the ideas, who's like a sponge and soaking all this up, and who do we trust, who are we able to trust when it really matters, when it really starts to do what we need them to do.
Last thing then is, this is our last sort of free bit of content. We'll be doing the post-match show tonight. If you want to subscribe, download the app, you can go from there if you're interested in all that. Tour's gone well. You know, if the key thing, as I was talking to James and Ian about, is just how vibrant everyone feels, to be honest with you. It feels like a bit of a trite thing to say, but I'm trying to put it over to the listeners. It's not when you're here. You know, you do get the genuine sense of everyone enjoying it, of Liverpool being very, very harmonious. And I think that where that matters most is obviously on the pitch. And hopefully we'll see a bit more of that tonight. But I think we'll definitely see it going into the season.
Yeah, I've quite liked it being first up, really. Because the first time it's been this early, and listen, it caught us out a little bit, didn't it? Yeah. In terms of the Anfield Wrap and our planning. But you know, now we're here, I sort of like it being early, really, because it's getting the squad all together early, and they've spoke about that. And when I spoke to a couple of the players, and at least one of them said, you know, it's nice to be all together, especially with the new lads. So they're coming away together, they're having all this time together. It's the bonding, but it's also a reminder for the ones who come before, and you know, the information for the new lads, just what a massive football club this is, and there's passionate fans all around the world. The fact that, you know, the club are flying out five legends just to do sort of, you know, the number of events they want. And just with Sammy Hupia there, who stayed for well over an hour to sign absolutely everything. And fair play to him, because he was, you know, he wasn't meant to stay that long, but he was like, I'll stay, I'll sign. He's not going to leave people in the queue, not with stuff. And, you know, this is, you know, so many miles away. You know, it's the same in Bangkok, and, you know, there's other countries I'm sure would love to host Liverpool and would show the exactly same passion. So I think this will be good. I think it'll be a good tour. Hopefully we can finish off with a win tonight, which will cap everything off. But I think, you know, from you know, what you see from the players, you know, speaking to a few people from the club and everything, they all think it's gone really well. You know, we've had a really good time. It's been boss to meet lots of new people and other supporters, clubs and stuff like that at the events. And, you know, just having a real laugh with the guys from Malaysia and them talking about celebrating 10 years of their supporters club, and absolutely fair play. And so, yeah, there's passion about Reds everywhere. And the more the team can feel it, the more they'll be powered from it, because that's been a crucial part of our success over the last few years and will continue to be in the future.
Excellent stuff. Thank you very much indeed to John. Earlier on, we had James and Ian. It was a real pleasure to speak to both of them as well. It's been Tour Live. Download the app. Get everything we've got going for you on the Anfield Wrap. We've had Kostas Tsimikas. We've had the manager himself. And there'll be loads and loads of post-match stuff after all of these friendlies before the season, where Liverpool try and win the league. Sports Social Podcast Network.